Ryan Stanton here with ASEP Frontline. Joined today again, follow-up episode with Dr. Blake Briggs, talking today about ectopic pregnancy in the ED, live recording from here at the Emerald Coast Conference in Destin, Florida. Back in person and live broadcast recordings once again. We look forward to it for the last 14 or 16 months and excited to have folks here to chat about the topics they have. If you haven't checked out his other podcast with me, it is Pain in the Neck, talking about a few of the can't-miss neck diagnoses. But today we're talking about, interestingly, a case that I just worked up a couple of days ago before coming down here in Florida, and something that is a big one for us in emergency medicine. You know, it's always on the radar when I have students in the ER. I always talk about the fact, just every patient that comes in, think about what's the worst case scenario, what's going to kill that person when they come in here. And then I have to prove to myself that that's not the case. And as I mentioned in the last podcast, we're not going to be perfect. We aren't expected to be, but the MD and DO after our names with the board certification for emergency medicine isn't for the stuff that presents obviously. It's for picking up and thinking outside the box and trying to think about the things that aren't the obvious presentation. So, Dr. Briggs, let's roll right into it. Give us a little background once again on yourself, and then let's talk about ectopics.
Sure. Thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure to be here again.
I mean, for us, it's only been like 45 seconds.
Exactly. But you know, the best part about podcasting is that people don't know this.
Yeah.
Until
now.
Now they do. It's all about the setup.
In the 45 seconds, we're still wearing the exact same.
Yes. You know,
and that's one of my favorite things about this conference.
Yes.
Is the fact that we get to come in. I mean, it's super humid here. The first year I came here, which was probably 2008, 2009, I showed up with my suit, had everything on. It's like 95 degrees, 96 degrees with, you know, if there's an opportunity to go past 100% humidity, it was accomplished at that point. And I showed up in my suit, and I had learned that first day that this is the conference where you get to dress like we all want to dress.
Yeah.
For the conferences, which is I've got on a basically a fishing style button-up shirt, short sleeves, often wearing shorts into the talks. And very comfortable. So if you have never done Emerald Coast Conference in Destin, next year is your chance, and you do not, you leave your suit at home because you don't need it while you're down here.
Wear all the Carhartt you want. That's what he's wearing right now, basically. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I've got on the fishing shirt.
It's got
the back breezes in case I really get worked up, you know, happen to catch a large fish out here on the coast here in the next couple of days. I've got my vented back shirt to make sure that I don't overheat with all the effort. But actually, it's just me and the family and the kids hanging out on the beach and around the pool the next few days. So, but it's good to have people back together.
Absolutely.
Finally having to get the actual clothes out of the closet, because we've been living in t-shirts and shorts and pajamas and our hospital-based attire for the last 16 to 18 months, but conferences are back in person, and so are our discussions and podcasting. All right, let's get back to it. Dr. Briggs.
Yeah, so again, I'm assistant professor at the University of South Alabama Department of Emergency Medicine in Mobile, Alabama, and did my training over at Wake Forest University for residency and undergrad as well. Ectopic pregnancy is one of those things that we all know it, we've learned about it, but you can never learn enough about it, I think. It's one of those classically common diagnoses. 2% of all pregnancies in the United States are going to be ectopic. And the scary thing is about up to 40% of these cases are actually misdiagnosed initially. So it's funny when, you know, I was assigned this topic and a few of my co-faculty at my program were like, why are you talking about ectopic pregnancy? We already know that. Well, clearly we don't, because 40% of these cases are misdiagnosed and mismanaged initially, so we could always learn more about it, right? And so when we're talking about ectopic pregnancy, we're talking about a presentation that actually is a little sneakier than we think. And, you know, the proof of this is in the pudding right here. So the most common symptom is going to be vaginal bleeding, which is very nonspecific. It can be spotty. It can be hemorrhaging. It doesn't really matter. And the second most common symptom is going to be abdominal pain. And this is, again, abdominal pain that has no pattern to it. Doesn't matter where it is. Doesn't matter what type of pain it is. It doesn't matter if it comes and goes. It's just there. And then about 20% of patients, interesting enough, present straight up ruptured. They come in, and they may or may not be hypotensive. They may or may not be tachycardic, but they're going to possibly have peritoneal signs, and they're going to have free fluid in their pelvis, and you're done. And it's an ectopic until proven otherwise, surgical abdomen. And then finally, there's the sneaky set of patients that we don't really know the exact percent on that come in about 6 to 8 weeks after their last menstrual period, and they just have quote-unquote pregnancy symptoms, right? They might have breast tenderness. They might have polyuria. They might have just nausea and vomiting, right? That's it. And we may think, oh, nausea and vomiting, positive pregnancy test, that's it. No belly pain, no vaginal bleeding. Go see your OB. Mm-hmm. Get out of here. you know, please get out of here. I'll say politely. Yeah. We'll send you a bill, surprise bill. So in general, though, the problem is that if you send those patients home, you could be sending home an ectopic. And that's one, a legal nightmare. And two, just most importantly, the patient. You know, we want to make sure that we take care of the patient in all scenarios. And we always keep that open mind to rule out ectopic pregnancy in any female reproductive age. And you hinted at this earlier, mm-hmm. and this is a great case of when I'm on shift working with the residents or medical students, and I'm saying, hey, when are you gonna get a pregnancy test on patients? And you get the usual answers, any dysuria, any abdominal pain, and that's about it, right? Any vaginal bleeding. And really, that's not the answer. I would say you should be thinking about pregnancy tests. We all know, if you've been practicing for a while, syncope, near syncope rule-outs, abdominal pain, some chest pain, depending on the story, any GU complaint, any lightheadedness or dizziness. You know, we all know that that's kind of the scenario of, it's not just anything below the diaphragm that you worry about ectopic pregnancy. It could be many different presentations. And the problem with ectopic pregnancy is we think about it, you're like, oh, shoot, ectopic pregnancy. That's the whole beta-HCG level, right? And then we have to give a follow-up test, you know, keep it simple. We don't worry about that. Number one thing, confirm the patient's pregnant. Mm-hmm. Get a urine test. It's positive. Okay, the clock is on. We got to think ectopic or intrauterine pregnancy. And at that point, of course, you're going to determine if the patient's hemodynamically stable. And that usually happens before the pregnancy test. The pregnancy test, even if it's a point of care, can take 30 minutes or so longer. And so you're thinking first is, am I dealing with a surgical abdomen or not? And when you're waiting for that, after the urine pregnancy test comes back positive, you're then going to order your serum, you know, quantitative HCG. You're going to order your CBC and CMP, whatever you do for other rule out of other conditions. And I would say the most commonly forgotten test at that moment, right then and there, is the blood type and Rh status. And that comes to play, as we both know, much more importantly, after the fact of the ectopics or intrauterine pregnancy is diagnosed, that'll be a big factor in that patient's care, their Rh status, whether or not they have an intrauterine pregnancy. And then you're going to order that bedside ultrasound, transvaginal ultrasound, and determine if they have intrauterine versus ectopic pregnancy, and you coordinate with OBGYN. So that's really just a simple 50,000-foot view of what we're doing with ectopic pregnancy. And really the discussion then goes into, okay, well, if all that's pretty easy, why are we talking about it? And I would add another variable to this is the people listening to this podcast are thinking, wait a minute, you know, you're suggesting getting this transvaginal ultrasound. What if I don't have transvaginal ultrasound mm-hmm. at my facility? Or what if I have to wait several hours and I got a patient that looks potentially sick or they're tachycardic and they have a belly pain? And what you can do is a bedside ultrasound. And yes, you can do a fast to look for free fluid. And that's simple enough, right? If you see free fluid on a fast and they have a surgical abdomen, a positive pregnancy test, you're done. You know, for all intents and purposes, you have an ectopic to approve and otherwise. But in other cases, let's say you have a hemodynamically stable patient with a positive pregnancy test and you're waiting for that transvaginal ultrasound, you can save a lot of time by doing your own transabdominal ultrasound, you know, getting that large abdominal probe and looking at their belly. And the evidence is fully supported behind this. The first thing saying, hey, our own bedside ultrasounds, we all know, lead to faster dispositions. They increase patient satisfaction. And, of course, they can diagnose an intrauterine pregnancy. And the second part of this, the flip side, is that emergency physicians are really good at bedside ultrasound. Mm-hmm. you know, studies have shown they're really good. And in particular, with a bedside first trimester pregnancy ultrasound, we're extremely good. You know, sensitivity above 70%, specificity greater than 90% in most cases. We're very, very good with just a little bit of training, a little bit of practice of putting a probe in the belly, looking for an intrauterine pregnancy. And in about one study, that same study I just quoted with the percents, they said that emergency physicians can identify an intrauterine pregnancy in over 70% of patients that present to the ED with a previously, you know, positive pregnancy test, an unknown pregnancy location. So we're very good at that. And so then it comes down to the discussion of, well, what order do I do things? What am I looking for? And what you're going to do with that transabdominal ultrasound is you're really going to look for three things that prove an intrauterine pregnancy and not fall into the traps that other people do. And sometimes, I hate to say it, even radiologists or techs will fall into traps. And the three things you're going to look for to prove there's an intrauterine pregnancy is a yolk sac, a fetal pulse, and or a fetal heart rate, depending on the age of that pregnancy, right, if you're good at seeing it.
Interestingly, you know, you talk about the ultrasound in combination, the ultrasound and HCG have mm-hmm. that upper 90s, 96% yes. sensitivity, 97% specificity for ectopic pregnancy. And then there's that combination tool, because it is completely variable. You know, a lot of facilities like my facility, because we have a birthing center, we have 24/7 access to transvaginal ultrasound, but a lot of critical access smaller hospitals may not have it. And so, as you talk about having those skills for bedside ultrasound, point of care ultrasound. In fact, I love that because I go in there identify intrauterine. In fact, anybody comes in with pregnancy, you know, as part of the CMS guidelines, especially if they haven't had confirmed intrauterine pregnancy,
yes,
it needs to be identified anyway. So being able to put that on there, say, yes, intrauterine pregnancy, fetal heart rate 146 beats per minute, whatever it may be, some of that data that you may have, saving images, if you can do that just for documentation and billing purposes. But, you know, this is a potentially scary diagnosis. You know, that percentage, the percentage of ectopic pregnancies has been growing.
Yes.
Consistently over the years, as you mentioned, about 2%, about 1.9 to 2% of pregnancies. So about 1 in 50 of the pregnancies that you're going to see, and most often they will present to the emergency department with the vaginal bleeding, abdominal pain potentially. But again, just like we talked about with the pain in the neck podcast, it's not always going to be these obvious symptoms. And depending on where they are in the criteria, you know, it may be relatively mild symptoms, but also maybe a very time-sensitive surgical emergency.
Yes.
That we may be getting them right before they kind of fall off the edge of that stability standpoint. To even throw a curveball in it, you know, there's been a few cases of negative pregnancy tests and positive ectopic pregnancy, but that's incredibly rare. When you talk about the zebra, that's the zebra when you're talking about those cases, yeah, of negative pregnancy tests and ectopic pregnancies. But, you know, that's one of the things that we heard is it doesn't necessarily grow at the same rate of HCGs, you know, just keeping an eye on it, but being able to identify. But you mentioned, and obviously in training we're often told you identify your intrauterine pregnancy, you're done. That's, yeah, not always the case. I actually had a friend that had the heterotopic type,
right,
case, had one in, one out.
Yeah.
So let's talk about those rare cases and some of the things that tip off, and then we'll also get into the idea of that, not only the things that we're going to look for, but some of the interventions we're going to make. So let's talk,
sure,
about heterotopic a little bit.
Sure. I was hoping you wouldn't bring this up, but
too bad.
But too bad. We're talking about it.
The question's
so
here.
This is one of those, again, a zebra case that is over, you know, one in over 50,000 cases in a normal patient that is not using any fertility treatment.
Mm-hmm.
That's the story here, and that's what is an important question to ask your patients when they come in and they have a positive pregnancy test. And it's a question I ask every patient as I'm doing my ectopic workup: is, are you seeing a fertility specialist? Are you doing anything like that? And you know, I work at a more of a level one, more of a county-based population, and that's not going to be the case most of the time. It's going to be a natural pregnancy. And so for those cases, the vast majority of the answers are no. You know, this was I wasn't on birth control, whoopsie, and now it could be an ectopic or intrauterine pregnancy. In those cases, I wouldn't worry about heterotopic, and I wouldn't go, mm-hmm, looking for them actively. And what is a heterotopic? Sorry, we should back up. Heterotopic, it lives in our nightmares. It is basically two pregnancies. You have an intrauterine pregnancy and an ectopic pregnancy at the same time. So an intrauterine pregnancy and an ectopic pregnancy at the same time, it's the stuff of nightmares, because let's say I go in the room, and I do the ultrasound, positive pregnancy test, and I say, wow, there's an intrauterine pregnancy, we're done. And in the vast majority of cases in your whole career, you would be done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's an intrauterine pregnancy. The risk of ectopic is almost zilch, and you're going to send them home. These are the patients that are, like I said, that are on fertility treatments of some type, and they are at risk for having that heterotopic pregnancy, and that's when you do the extra step of getting, you're going to get a formal ultrasound regardless. And even the formal ultrasound can miss a heterotopic. They might go look at, you know, flash over to the right or left ovary and say, oh, corpus luteal cyst,
mm-hmm,
and there's intrauterine pregnancy, you're done. And in reality, that could be an ectopic hanging out in the right or left ovary. And again, yeah, I just want to emphasize again, these are rare conditions. I would not, if in the vast majority of patients that have a positive pregnancy test and a transabdominal ultrasound or transvaginal, whether or not you've done it or the tech did it, that shows an intrauterine pregnancy and all counts looks normal, and they are not on fertility treatment of any type, not seeing fertility specialists, I would say you are fine sending that patient out if they are hemodynamically stable and look fine overall.
To give you the idea of how rare it is,
yes,
the quoted, so we say that the ectopic is about 1 in 50. The estimated incidence of heterotopic pregnancies and spontaneous pregnancies is 1 in 30,000.
Yes.
So that is hideously rare. The chances of us even seeing it during our,
correct,
well, even an OBGYN seeing it during their career is pretty rare. But as you mentioned, with the reproductive assistance technology, or assisted reproductive technology, ART as it's called in the vernaculum, it's about 1 in 3,900.
Mm-hmm.
So even then, it's incredibly rare, but about 10 times more likely than just the natural occurrence,
right,
in spontaneous pregnancy. So again, incredibly rare, I just happened to know somebody from my hometown growing up that had a heterotopic pregnancy. Everything turned out just fine, but it's one of those things that, as you mentioned, nightmares. It's an emergency medicine.
It's a nightmare.
It's about different levels of nightmares, and how do you live with the nightmares? Because there's,
yeah,
that gets into the realm of things that are so rare that we're likely to do more harm.
Correct.
Chasing that trail than actually just assuming the numbers associated with how rare it's going to be. We've all got attending physicians that, will chase down every single rabbit trail on every single patient.
Well, this one time. Yeah.
This one time 25 years ago, I heard about this person that had this in a book, in a novel, in a magazine or whatever it may be back when they printed journals or whatever it was.
From Indonesia.
Yeah, different country. And it's super rare, but I'm going to chase down every one of those. And we do have to think about the cost and the risk of our false positives, of our evaluations, and those types of things. And you have to draw a line of accepted miss rate. And in theory, we have an accepted miss rate of zero in anything in medicine. At least that's what the public has for us as physicians. But in reality, we know that that's not simply the case, that there's zebras almost at every zoo. And sometimes the zebras are zebras. It's even a more unique zebra, kind of the Zorse type of things, where it's a horse with zebra stripes.
Or horizontal stripes, zebra.
Yes, yeah, or horizontal exactly. stripes. Or, yeah. In Tijuana, the donkeys that have zebra stripes. And you pay a little extra money to have your picture taken with them. So we've talked a little bit about the heterotopic pregnancies.
Yeah.
If there's something big concerning, you see an entry in pregnancy. This is one reason we have follow-up in the mixtures,
sure.
because follow-up a lot of times is for those rare, when we decide to go to the zoo and see the zebras. And we'll catch some of them, but sometimes it's for a follow-up appointment. If they don't have significant hemoperitoneum, they're not hemodynamically unstable, you get entry in pregnancy, those are things that can likely be followed up. But what are some of the big risk factors? Because we are seeing, it's one of the rare things
yes.
that we're seeing increased numbers right
sure.
now versus 20, 30 years ago. What are the risk factors associated with those ectopic pregnancies?
Sure. So, there are common myths associated with ectopic pregnancy as well, too. But for risk factors-wise, you're going to have older patients, maternal smoking, and, of course, everyone's favorite risk factor, a previous ectopic pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is one of those things where the right answer on the test, again, I do the podcast called EM Board Bombs, and so we joke that when in doubt on the test, your answer choice is always, did you have this condition again? That's your biggest risk factor. Did you have it before? It's probably going to happen again. Dissection, ACS, anything, ectopic pregnancy is no different from that. If you've had one before, you could get it again easily. That's the biggest risk factor. But in terms of other risk factors, like we said, older maternal age, maternal smoking, any cocaine use as well. And funny enough, one of the traps we fall into, and this is going to be a wrong answer on the test too, is that an IUD does not increase the risk of ectopic pregnancy. And, something that we either were mistaught in med school or didn't read the fine print, and an intrauterine device presence does not increase the risk of ectopic pregnancy. It actually lowers your risk because overall, it lowers your risk of getting pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
The risk of getting pregnant of an IUD, funny enough, is actually lower than the risk of getting pregnant with a tubal ligation. That's how great the technology today of IUDs are. Now, this wasn't the case probably 20, 30 years ago, but today's IUDs, either the Paragard or Mirena, for example, or Skyla, those IUDs are so good that their risk of ectopic, again, is lower than the general population because their risk of pregnancy is less than 0.5%. Now, caveat here, if you have an IUD and you get pregnant, then yes, your chance of an ectopic is very high. But overall, your risk is low, right? So the point is, if you have an IUD, I've heard patients say this, and I've heard other providers say this, is they say, oh, they have an IUD, they have a higher risk of getting ectopic. Actually, not true at all. They have a much lower risk than the general population because they're just not going to get pregnant. But if they do have a pregnancy, then 9 times out of 10, my own statistic, I just made that up, is going to be an ectopic pregnancy. You just need to worry about
it.
Yeah, I got to say it confidently. That's what happens when you podcast. You got to be confident. So the other risks and kind of myths that are going into this, if you don't mind, I'm going to segue into that, is that the two traps, and we talked about traps with pain in the neck, other traps you got to worry about is, one, there is no such thing as a discriminatory zone. And this discriminatory zone was this classic teaching that I was taught in med school, you were taught in med school, they're still probably teaching it in med school, is that, hey, there's this cutoff level of an HCG, and if it's below that, don't even do the ultrasound, you're not going to see a pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
See you later. See him outpatient. It's not true at all. The original thought was that a transabdominal ultrasound, the quote-unquote cutoff, meaning that whatever level this HCG, beta HCG is at, greater than 4,000, you're going to see a pregnancy at that time. And then the transvaginal ultrasound cutoff was 1,500, around there. This turns out to be completely true. I mean, sorry, back up. This turns out to be completely false, meaning that...
I was about to say, you just did a 180.
Yeah, no, exactly.
This is amazing.
Yeah, yeah. It turns out everything you learned in med school was right.
It's perfect.
Yeah, you don't need to study anymore, actually, and you don't need to read journals. So, and there's no point in coming to conference. So, so this whole thing was false. And what they found out was actually, it could be the opposite. And this, you know, one prospective study showed that actually, if you have a lower level of beta-HCG and you have an ectopic, a pregnancy you couldn't find the ultrasound, you have a higher risk of that being an ectopic potentially. Mm-hmm. And so what does this mean for us? This means that when you're in the emergency department and you want that transvaginal ultrasound done, let's say you already tried your transabdominal ultrasound. I've done this a lot of times. This happens so often to me. You know, I'll tell the resident to go in the room and say, hey, order the transvaginal, let's go do our own transabdominal ultrasound. I don't care what the, you know, quantitative beta HCG level is. Let's just go look anyway. One, it's good practice. Two, we may find intrauterine pregnancy and we're done, right? Mm-hmm. And you send them out. When we order that transvaginal shirt off my resident or I, we'll get a call from the ultrasound tech or radiology department saying, hey, we can't do that ultrasound until we get a quant back. And that's unacceptable. And for the people out there listening, I would not... You know, I would politely make sure that you are not being pushed around by other departments saying, we're not doing the ultrasound until you get a quant back, because that's just not true anymore. There's no discriminatory zone where you have to think, I need to get that back before I get my transvaginal. You know, you've seen it in your career. I've seen it in my career. I'm sure everyone listening has seen plenty of ectopics and intrauterine pregnancies with quants all over the place. There's absolutely almost no correlation. You can imagine the variability in the female patient themselves, in the pregnancy itself, of the variety of beta HCG numbers. So that's one thing I remember here, that a single quant number is not really helpful because you can't trend it, right? You have one quant number in the ED and you don't know what the previous number was. You don't know what the next number will be. I would never let that stop you from getting a transvaginal ultrasound.
Now, that being said though, I think there are certain numbers where you better find something.
Correct.
Like if you get to a certain number.
Absolutely.
And there's not a cutoff, but if I'm in the thousands.
Yes.
I better find something.
For sure.
Unless there's a story that suggests I just passed tissue and completed a miscarriage. I mean, there's places where you say, I better find something. At this point, I need to find intrauterine, or we need to have a much higher index of suspicion. But I completely agree that we all see that. And you know, I see that with when we're ruling out ectopic a lot of times, I'll have them say, well, we want to wait until it's like, no, this is potentially a dangerous, life-threatening surgical emergency.
Yes, absolutely.
I need you in here to take care of this right now. And you actually mentioned the previous ectopic pregnancy. That is actually listed as the number one risk factor. And of course, the other thing we hear about is in training and residency and med school is the STIs, mm-hmm. The significant history of STIs. Is that still holding true with PID history, or is that something that's falling off as well?
No, it's there, and I didn't mention it because I was so gung-ho in my soapbox about IUDs. But yeah, I completely agree with you that any previous DNCs, any scarring of the uterine lining, or the fallopian tube absolutely is a risk factor. I would say in the top five risk factors in my own order of risk factors. That's one we see commonly come up is any prior history of PID or infections or instrumentation of any type of the upper female genital tract.
And you actually, and that's an important mention and ask, because often we'll talk.
Yes.
You know, when we have people with abdominal pain, say, do you have a history of abdominal surgery? And so that big question is, you know, and you know, we still see the whole, oh, they've had a tubal ligation, we're done, there's nothing else.
Absolutely.
And that's just, couldn't be further from the truth. We've seen things fail. We've seen shoddy work there. We've seen, you know, of course, ectopic pregnancies associated. And so keeping that broad index of suspicion for the previous ectopics, prior fallopian tube surgery, pelvic abdominal surgery, STIs, pelvic inflammatory disease, endometriosis, mm-hmm. you know, all of those typical players with regard to keeping that open when somebody comes in. But I, you know, we talked about the ultrasound, and of course, you know, we talk about some of the education and books that are at least a decade, if not longer, behind. Just think about the changes in the ultrasound technology during that mm-hmm. time. You know, when I started training, we had a hand-me-down used OBGYN ultrasound machine that was weighed as much as a small car and had terrible pictures. It was like looking at a 1950s black and white TV that had lines across it and static and everything else. You could hardly see anything. And the technology now that we have with these bedside point-of-care ultrasounds is just incredible comparatively. It's night and day difference in terms of what we can see and what we can evaluate, and that is something that definitely needs to be within the wheelhouse skills of emergency physicians, is to do that bedside point-of-care ultrasound with regard to intrauterine pregnancy, doing those basic evaluations and studies to kind of gauge what's going on with that patient. Any closing thoughts with regard to things that we haven't missed, that we haven't talked about or discussed with regard to ectopics?
Yeah, two things, two more traps you want to fall into, either on your bedside or your transvaginal ultrasound. Make sure that you know that the presence of a gestational sac alone does not diagnose an intrauterine pregnancy. And the problem with this is because if you're waiting on a radiology read or waiting on the tech to tell you what they found, they may mistake that for intrauterine pregnancy. And so we talked about way at the beginning of this podcast of saying what defines intrauterine pregnancy. It's the yolk sac plus or minus a fetal pole, depending on the age of the pregnancy, and a fetal heart rate, depending on the age of the pregnancy. But if you don't see any three of those, and you just see that gestational sac, which is this echogenic rim basically inside the center of the uterus in an anechoic center. Mm-hmm. It's what surrounds the yolk sac. If you just see the gestational sac, that could very well be what we call a pseudo-gestational sac, which is found in patients with ectopic pregnancy, a significant number of them as well. Just the presence alone of a quote-unquote pseudo-gestational sac. So don't dismiss that and say, oh, I see pregnancy, see you later. That could easily be associated with an ectopic pregnancy, the presence of just a gestational sac alone. The second kind of cold hard fact you have to realize is that 20% of positive pregnancy patients basically in all ERs across the country are going to have a non-diagnostic ultrasound. And it's important that you say non-diagnostic ultrasound, not negative ultrasound. Mm-hmm. And you said this earlier a little bit of saying we should see something, right, at a certain level of a beta HCG. And up to 30% of females with ectopic pregnancies will have no ultrasound findings early on. And that's really important here. And that's important to tell the patient. That's important to tell the OBGYN when you're calling them for follow-up, right? And don't just say they have a negative ultrasound. Just say, I don't see anything ultrasound. It's non-diagnostic right now, depending on their level, right, their quant. And what they need is to follow up in 48 hours. And that's what you need to fight for your patient here. And I've had this problem, even academic center, is when, you know, my resident and I will work up an ectopic pregnancy, and it'll be one of these cases. You'll have a non-diagnostic ultrasound. Radiology will, and I'm not picking on radiology here, but the resident or the tech or something will put in the note saying, negative ultrasound, follow up in a couple weeks. That's completely inappropriate. These patients have a positive pregnancy test. They have a non-diagnostic ultrasound. And what you'll do is you'll call OBGYN and say, they need, can they see you in clinic in like 2 days? They need a repeat quant. They need a potentially repeat ultrasound. And it's really important that in emergency medicine, as always, we fight for our patients and say, hey, we know they're not established somewhere with OBE. Maybe they are. But if they're not, we want to really make sure these patients are not lost to follow-up. And you make it clear to the patient that if they can't find an appointment, just come back to the emergency department as soon as possible to get that repeat quant or ultrasound. So those are really the two other traps we want to make sure we avoid. So I guess the three traps total to summarize here would be no such thing as a discriminatory zone. So stop looking for those cutoffs and always push back when someone's telling you that we're not going to get the ultrasound until you quant back. I would never wait for that. Second trap is don't rely on just the presence of a gestational sac to diagnose intrauterine pregnancy. And the third trap is if you have a non-diagnostic ultrasound, it's not negative. It could just be a very early pregnancy or a very early ectopic pregnancy. And up to 40% of all pregnancies early on in the first trimester are pregnancies of unknown locations. You know, we don't really know where they are yet. And you have to just repeat an ultrasound, repeat a quant.
It's, you mentioned 1 in 10 ectopic pregnancies will present with a pseudo-gestational sac. So mm-hmm. that's a pretty decent percentage of those. So you're saying 1%, excuse me, 1 in 50. So about actually 1 in 500 pregnancies are going to come in with a gestational sac and actually be an ectopic pregnancy, mm-hmm. if I did my quick mind math here.
Sure, I'll
correctly.
Believe you. You said it confidently.
I said it confidently.
Yeah.
So keep that in your mind. Keep broad differential. Again, remember that with ectopic pregnancies, the location of the ectopic is kind of important with regard to the risk associated, the hemorrhagic risk, rupture risk. You know, because again, relatively early may not be a huge risk factor, but a lot of that depends on where it's located, whether it's within the fallopian tube, whether it's intra-abdominal, wherever it may be, is something that needs to be kept in mind. I mean, we've all seen the case in medical school, the person who had a pregnancy attached to the liver, just right. completely squirrel zebras on zebras again, type diagnoses. So that this is another one of those that's very important, as is anything intra-abdominal, to say we don't have exactly what's going on, the differentials here, this is what we are seeing, this is what we're not seeing, but close follow-up, reevaluation, return to the emergency department for any worsening or concerns, working with OBGYN in terms of treatment. Sometimes that treatment in terms of ectopic pregnancy, if confirmed, is initiated in the emergency department with medication-induced medical abortions, or that may be done in the emergency department. Again, that needs to have very close follow-up and evaluation. And actually, one thing that we're seeing now more often, and I've actually saw one this last week, is elective abortions that did not have any type of ultrasound prior, and coming in with pain and bleeding, and once again, evaluation for that ectopic pregnancy as well. Keep that on the differential.
Absolutely.
How can folks get in touch with you, your podcast as well, moving forward if they want to check things out?
Sure. So my Twitter handle is at Blake Briggs, MD, and our podcast is easy to find. We're also on Twitter at Ian Board Bombs, but we have our own website, and we're really more than just a podcast now. We're a platform, and we work with ACIP, as I've said earlier. We basically spice up some of their excellent peer review questions and make them outrageous question stems. Our motto is come for the stems, stay for the content, and we've been doing it for several years now, the Emergency Medicine Board Bombs podcast, and we really are the only board-dedicated emergency medicine podcast, but we're more than that. You know, we like to say we're a platform. We do our own handouts that are two-page review summaries of these topics, things we've talked about recently, like ectopic pregnancy are there, and we have our own podcast that can be found on any platform, listening device. We have our own interactive board study podcast, question podcast. So, again, you can look at my Twitter handle and find us anywhere, but shoot me an email if you have any questions.
Yeah, checking out here. You got your podcast listed on the website right there. You've got the What is that? Is that the old Yeti? Is that the Yeti mic? Or?
Oh, yeah. That was from the starting days.
That was back in the early days. So everybody in EM podcasting had a Yeti mic at some point. Yeah. I had a Blue Spark.
It's a solid mic.
It's a solid. It is a good, great way to get started. And there you guys right there. You can get your coffee mugs as well. And go and get things checked out. Not that I'm here snooping your website right
That's
now.
That's fine.
But
take a look.
We're absolutely. And as for me, you can contact me, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com or rstanton@asep.org. That's probably the easiest, rstanton@asep.org. On Twitter, @everydaymed, as well as making sure that whatever platform you use, we're on most of them, from Stitcher to iTunes to SoundCloud and iHeartRadio. Subscribe to the podcast. You're getting every weekly subscription and drop of our podcast. We're going to continue now with more of our live interviews as we start to see the reemergence of live conferences. We've got Emerald Coast Conference. We'll be at Leadership and Advocacy with ACEP in Washington, D.C. in July. We're going to talk about some of the corporate aspect of emergency medicine as well. And then coming up this fall, we are returned to live scientific assembly in Boston for ACEP 21. And once again, we will take some of those best and brightest educators and minds of emergency medicine and bring them to you and share that content with you. So until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ACEP Frontline.